Section 3. Elemental Definitions. I must first define some terms I will frequently use. Other terms I define as I present them, including a few already in Chapter 1. These definitions are not intended to be normative, so there is no sense in arguing whether my definitions are right or wrong. They merely specify what I mean when I use those terms, regardless of what anyone else might mean, or what any dictionaries say, or any other conventions. As long as you treat my definitions as nothing more than explanations of what I mean, confusion will be forestalled. I shall use God, lowercase, to mean any celestial being with supernatural power, and God, uppercase, to mean a supreme creator deity, though by this definition, angels and demons are indeed gods, lowercase. I'll sometimes, but not always, use angel or archangel to refer to gods, lowercase, that are believed to be acting as messengers or servants of God, uppercase, and demon to refer to gods, lowercase, who are believed to be acting in opposition to God, uppercase. The terminology was already this fluid, even among early Christians. For example, just look at 2 Corinthians 4, verse 4, 1 Corinthians 8, verse 5, or Galatians 4, verses 8 to 9. Although I will also on occasion use demon more neutrally in the context of pagan belief, in which there were both good and evil demons, all of whom gods in the lowercase. I shall mean by Jesus Christ, meanwhile, the name given by the earliest known Christians to a man who is believed to have historically existed, whether on earth or only in heaven or both, and who have in some sense originated the Christian religion. For the meaning of his name, go back to chapter 6, section 2. I shall mean by Christianity and all cognate terms any cult venerating this Jesus Christ as a divine being. And by cult, of course, I do not mean the pejorative, but the standard anthropological term for any community of worship distinguished by a system of religious rituals and doctrines. I shall mean by Messiah, the Hebrew word of which Christ is a translation, any man, in fact, myth, or prophecy, who is A, anointed by the Hebrew God, to B, play a part in God's plan to liberate his chosen people from their oppressors, and C, restore or institute God's true religion. This means anointed in any sense then understood, literally, figuratively, cosmically, or symbolically, and liberate in any sense then claimed, physically or spiritually. Also oppressors in any sense then identified, whoever or whatever they may be, and religion in the fullest sense, cult, mores, sacred knowledge, and the resulting social order. And I specify only play a part, not necessarily bring to fruition. All Jewish kings and high priests were, of course, messiahs in the basic sense of being anointed to represent God. But here I shall mean a messiah conforming to A through C. Yet I do not assume there must be only one messiah of that kind, and neither did the Jews, as I'll show in Elements 3 and 4 shortly. I've seen some scholars question or deny that the Jews had any prior notion of a Messiah before the advent of Christianity, but such a denial is accomplished only by proposing an implausibly hyperspecific definition of Messiah, then showing no such thing was previously imagined, and concluding, quote, the Jews had no prior notion of a Messiah, end quote. This is a textbook fallacy of equivocation. Start with a term defined one way, then end with the same term defined in a completely different way, often without noticing a switch has been made. To avoid this, I shall stick to my minimal definition, since I am certain anyone meeting criteria A, B, and C would have been regarded by at least some ancient Jews or Judaizers as a messiah. I attach no other baggage to the term, no particular eschatology or scheme of liberation. Jews of antiquity were clearly quite flexible in all such details, as everyone agrees, as I'll show for element 2. I shall mean by crucifixion, meanwhile, and being crucified and all other cognate terms and phrases, as any hanging up of the living or dead as a punishment, regardless of the exact details of how. The shape of the cross or fixture, the position of the body, whether the victim is killed first or hung while alive and left to die, even the manner of hanging, whether nailing or lashing, or whether to a rock or tree or stake or doorway or anything else, all of that can and certainly did vary, and yet the act still constitutes crucifixion, if A, a body is hanged by anything other than a noose around the neck, and B, this hanging is a punishment. Even the ancient terminology was no more specific than that. In fact, it was less so. Hence, I see no valid reason ours should be. For example, the Bible described one method of execution as to, quote-unquote, hang in the sun. In the Septuagint, literally, exhaliasdo, in other words, exhalio, out in the sun, or apananti tu helio, against the sun, which implies the intent was for the hanged to die from exposure. Just look at Numbers 25, verse 4, and 2 Samuel 21, verses 6, 9, and 13. That is essentially a form of crucifixion, however it was effected. Likewise, when Joshua hung on trees the king of Ai and the kings of the Amorites in Joshua 8, verse 29, and 10, verses 26 to 27, and when the law of Moses calls for the executed to be hanged on trees or planks, xulon in the Greek, even when already dead, in Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 to 23, or when Haman and his sons are hung on a giant pole, xulon again in Greek translations of Esther 5, verse 14, 7, verses 9 to 10, and 8, verse 7. These are all forms of crucifixion. Many scholars of Jewish antiquity now agree. In using the term crucifixion this way, I do not mean to rule out finer distinctions for those who want to make them. Someone else, for example, may want to restrict the term to an actual means of killing, thus including only those hung up alive to die, rather than the hanging of corpses. But since I see no contradiction in the idea of crucifying a corpse, and the ancient terminology does not exclude it, I think such a restriction is too fastidious. Since there was no standard practice of crucifixion even among the Romans, we can't be sure if everyone they crucified was nailed, or merely tied up, or even impaled, or exactly where, or how, or to what. If we are too particular, we will anachronistically exceed the ideas and vocabulary of the period. The Greek word for crucify, starao, literally means staked or palisaded, and frequently meant not just crucified but also impaled, or even setting up spiked walls around a fort. Hence, to stake, starao, someone on a pole, xulon, is what happens in the early Greek translation of Esther 7, verse 9, using the exact same verb used of the crucifixion of Jesus in the New Testament, as well as the exact same word for post or tree used in the Septuagint text of the Old Torah Law, that passage in Deuteronomy, which is also the same word used for the cross and crucifixion of Jesus in the New Testament. Thus, as the ambiguity existed then, I preserve it myself. I shall mean by resurrection, and all similar terms, any restoration of life to the dead, whether permanent or not, though I shall distinguish when the term is used literally or figuratively. Merely the survival or ascension of an already immortal soul does not count as a restoration in this sense, and thus is not a resurrection. But abandoning the corpse altogether and rising to life in a completely new body does count, and thus is a resurrection. As with the term Messiah, I've seen recent attempts to claim that pagans had no notion of resurrection, again by producing a hyper-specific definition of one particular kind of resurrection, proving they didn't have or accept it, then concluding they had no notion of resurrection at all. But such specificity did not exist in ancient vocabulary. Many different Jewish and Christian sects believed in many different kinds of resurrection, and all were called resurrection. And there were yet more kinds of resurrection imagined among the pagans, and considerable overlap between their ideas and those of the Jews and Christians. I shall thus avoid any fallacy of anachronistic precision by using all words for resurrection to mean just what they meant to everyone in antiquity, whether pagan, Jew, or Christian, arising from a state of death to be alive again, nothing more. I shall mean by outer space everything above the atmosphere as presently known. In ancient understanding, this included A, everything in or under the firmament, also known as the air or sublunar sphere, extending above the highest visible clouds all the way to the orbit of the moon, and B, all the heavens beyond, also then known as the ether or ethereal realm. The notion that any of this region may have been a vacuum did exist at the time, but only as a controversial theory rejected by most religious cosmologists, and only embraced typically by atomists and others generally hostile to the supernatural. Most people of the time thought the air extended all the way to the moon, while everything beyond that was filled with a breathable ether, when in fact, as we now know, the real atmosphere extends only a minuscule fraction of that distance. So when they spoke of beings and events in the air, quote-unquote, they were often speaking of what we mean by outer space. This is even more obvious when they spoke of beings and events in the spheres of heaven above the moon. Accordingly, if an ancient author was speaking of what we would call outer space, I will say outer space. This does not mean I attribute to them a modern knowledge of the extraterrestrial vacuum. It only means they were thinking of realms beyond the terrestrial domains of mountains, clouds, and birds. For it was already common knowledge among the educated of the time that the moon's distance from the Earth was hundreds of thousands of miles. So when they used terms that we often translate as air, they were often not referring to what we mean by the air today, but a far more vast and frightening realm of fantastic possibilities, which many thought was trafficked by gods and filled with strange animals or spirits. I shall use gospel for the general idea of the quote-unquote good news or quote-unquote salvific message that any group of Christians or other savior cult may have preached, and which may have varied in content from group to group. I shall also use gospel for the actual written books of that title or genre, which attempted to convey a gospel in some fashion or other. In accordance with growing convention, I shall also use Septuagint to mean, in fact, the translation of the Old Testament into Greek made by the Jewish scholar Theodotion in the 2nd century, whereas previous to Christianity was the similar but not always identical Old Greek translation, which is no longer completely extant. I shall also use church to mean any Christian congregation, regardless of sect or state of organization, and the church as a stand-in for the whole Christian movement in all its diversity. I will also sometimes use church to mean any major regional Christian institution, or all of them collectively, that had the political power to force compliance and suppress heresy among its own adherents. By this definition, the Coptic, Eastern Orthodox, and Catholic churches became the most prominent and powerful churches. But churches in this sense didn't likely exist anywhere until the 2nd century at the earliest. Before that, the church only consisted of diverse and loosely affiliated churches. I shall use orthodox, or orthodoxy, to refer to all the churches, literature, and institutions, and their ideologies and interpretations, that eventually evolved over the course of the 4th century AD into the politically victorious sects that we now call churches in the big sense, or the church today. I shall use heretical and all related terms for all other churches. Though no church of those later periods much resembled any churches of the 1st and 2nd centuries, as most scholars agree, Christian ideology, institutions, and beliefs had by then changed considerably, the consolidated sects that would later call their view orthodoxy and all others heresy did evolve from one particular lineage of the era, albeit with continual cross-fertilization with other Christian sects and even pagan cults. And then it kept or altered documents from that era that supported that, and destroyed or abandoned documents that did not, creating a selection bias in the preservation of literature that bears a particular, albeit anachronistic and often inconsistent, sectarian stamp. So when I speak of an orthodox sect in the first two centuries, I do not mean the sect that was closer or more faithful to the originating traditions of the religion. I believe all sects deviated from the original religion and innovated freely and in equal measure. And the victorious churches of the early Middle Ages looked nothing at all like the original faith of Peter or even Paul. Rather, I mean the sects that evolved into those later churches, bearing the closest ancestral relationship to them in ideology and institutional continuity. Thus, I am not endorsing any church's claim to orthodoxy or right doctrine, nor am I using terms like heretical pejoratively, but rather acknowledging that a small handful of churches, such as the Orthodox, Coptic, and Catholic, gained dominance in certain regions and then called themselves Orthodox. None of these churches sprang out of nowhere, but all evolved from earlier sects that bear a closer resemblance to them than other sects did, and their selection, modification, and endorsement of documents reflects what they chose to call orthodoxy, hence, for convenience, social eye.